Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for August 13th, 2013. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'll be speaking with Diomedes Logothetis and Raul Mahajan about using a computational method to predict how an ion channel is activated by binding to its regulators. In atrial cardiomyocytes, activation of G-protein-regulated inwardly rectifying potassium channels, or GIRCs, causes the heart rate to slow. GIRCs allow potassium ions to flow out of the cell, which hyperpolarizes the cell and slows the rate at which the cell contracts. GIRCs are activated when they interact with G-proteins, which are released by stimulation of G-protein-coupled receptors. Because the binding of G-proteins to GIRCs is so important in regulating heart rate, it's necessary to understand how these proteins interact and how G-protein binding leads to GIRC activation. However, it's proven challenging to co-crystallize these proteins together in a complex to examine their interactions in detail. To overcome this technical hurdle, Raul Mahajan and Diomedes Logothetis have used a computational method to predict the interactions between G-proteins and a GIRC and then tested these predictions in cells. The end result is a model for how G-proteins cause activation of GIRCs. And the study also demonstrates an approach for using computational methods to address protein-protein interactions when crystals of complexes are not available. Logothetis and Mahajan spoke to me from the Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome, Dr. Logothetis, Dr. Mahajan.
Hello.
Hi, Annalisa.
Diomedes, how important is the activity of GIRC channels for regulating heart rate?
In the body, the parasympathetic nervous system regulates heart rate by releasing a transmitter, acetylcholine, to the heart. And there are specific receptors called muscarinic receptors that are found either in pacemaking cells of the heart or atrial cells of the heart that bind the acetylcholine and in turn activate G-proteins, particular type of G-proteins that are sensitive to pertussis toxin. And these activated G-proteins then in turn activate the potassium channels, the GIRC channels as we call them, that hyperpolarize the membrane potential and decrease activity, therefore slowing heart rate.
How does the G-proteins binding to the GIRC channels regulate the activity of those channels?
In 1987, we discovered that it was the beta-gamma subunits of the heterotrimeric G-proteins that once they dissociated from the alpha subunits, they could act on the potassium channels and activate them. At the time, this was the first known protein that the beta-gamma subunits were activating. After that, several other proteins were discovered, and now it's well accepted that the beta-gamma subunits activate proteins once signals from outside the receptor, like acetylcholine, act on the receptors and activate the proteins. Now, ever since 1987, it's been really a dream for many people involved trying to solve this problem all over the world to figure out how the beta-gamma subunits specifically interact with the channel and how is that interaction cause the channel to open its gates so that it can conduct potassium ions.
In terms of the structural or the molecular basis of how the G-proteins activate the channel, the most straightforward way to look at that is to co-crystallize the G-proteins bound to the channel and to solve that structure by X-ray crystallography. But that hasn't been possible yet for GIRCs and G-proteins. Why?
It is true that it is not really trivial at all to crystallize complexes of proteins, and in particular, if some of these proteins are membrane proteins. It took one of the best labs in the world, that of Rod McKinnon's lab at Rockefeller University, over 10 years to achieve this goal. So when you have a membrane protein, it's pretty tough to figure out the conditions that you need to use to keep them soluble, to keep them apart from one another so that they don't form globs of aggregates, and at the same time to allow them to order themselves in a way that can help form these regular arrays that one has in a protein crystal. So this is a pretty tough thing to do, and so that's why there are many fewer membrane protein crystal structures than there are soluble proteins. Now, on top of having the channel crystallized, the task of capturing it in a stable form so that the beta-gamma subunits that weakly interact with this channel can be co-crystallized is even a tougher call. So Worden and McKinnon from McKinnon's lab first reported the first full-length GERC2 channel in 2011, and just a month ago, they were able to co-crystallize it with G-beta-gamma. So it's taken this lab 10 years from the first time that they had parts of the channel crystallized to get to the point where they had it with G-beta-gamma.
So, Raul, in the absence of a co-crystal of G-proteins and GERC, how did you figure out the structural basis of G-protein activation of GERC channels?
We took a computational approach to identify the key interactions between the two proteins. Crystal structure coordinates of the G proteins by themselves have been published since the mid-1990s, and within the last 10 years, GERC channel structures, like Diomedes mentioned, have also been available. So what we did was we carried out protein-protein docking of these published coordinates of the GERC channel, of the GERC1 channel in particular, and the G protein beta-gamma subunit. Now, protein-protein docking is a field in its own right, and there are many published freely available docking programs, each with its individual strengths and weaknesses. So rather than try to choose a particular docking program, we relied on a multi-stage docking approach that combined several docking programs in series, and it basically funneled the results of one docking program as the inputs for the next docking step. Using this algorithm yielded a very strongly favorably scored model of the GERC1 G-beta-gamma complex. So analysis of the conserved residues and other residues previously implicated by mutagenesis suggested a mechanism by which the G-beta-gamma binding might stabilize a particular conformation of the channel where one of its permeation gates is open. Many of the GERC1 G-beta-gamma interactions we identified in our model are actually shared by the recently published co-crystal of the GERC2 G-beta-gamma. However, the crystal structure of the GERC2 G-beta-gamma is not identical to our experimentally validated model of GERC1 G-beta-gamma. And the orientation of G-beta-gamma seen in the crystal structure is of a slightly different orientation. But again, many of the key interactions remain preserved between the co-crystal and our model.
The modeling predicted that binding of G-beta-gamma to GERC stabilizes the channel in an open conformation. How does it do that?
Basically, the model that we generated told us that beta-gamma comes sort of between two arms of a cleft and kind of inserts itself into that cleft. And then there are key interactions that it has with the channel to stabilize the arms of this cleft to be apart from one another. In fact, you know, when we look back at the literature, we know that alcohols also activate these GERC channels, and alcohols also seem to bind just sort of in that cleft that beta-gamma turns out to bind and stabilize its arms to be apart from one another. So occupying that cleft, whether it's through G-beta-gamma or perhaps alcohols, is really stabilizing these conformations that lead to stabilizing an intracellular gate, what we call the G-loop gate, in a conducting conformation. And this, again, comes from other studies that we have performed to see how this intracellular gate opens. And it seems that exactly this cleft opening and stabilization of its two arms in an open conformation leads to this stabilization of the cytosolic gate being open.
Did the predictions from your modeling study hold true in cells?
Yes. I mean, computational predictions are extremely useful, but they require experimental data to back them up. We carried out experiments in mammalian cells that served two purposes. One, to validate the interactions predicted by our model, and two, to validate the hypothesized gating mechanism based on our model via stabilization of a cleft on the channel. By changing the size, the charge, or by cross-linking residues involved in the predicted interactions, we showed that the model and the proposed mechanism holds up in mammalian cells and proteins.
What can you do with that structural information? Can it help in developing new ways to therapeutically regulate heart rate, given that these channels play an important role in that?
heart rate is controlled by a number of things, and activation of this channel is good in slowing it. The key thing here to realize is that this model is giving us a very final step of how the G-beta gamma interacts with the channel to do what acetylcholine has signaled to basically activate this channel. It's the final step in a long process from the binding of the ligand to the changing of the receptor conformation to the changing of the G-protein conformations and finally to the beta-gamma binding to the channel. So that gives us really a very nice tool that if we wanted to do rational drug design to find small molecules that interfere with that kind of beta-gamma channel interaction, we could develop a blocker. Now, is there any need for a blocker? And in fact, chronic atrial fibrillation is a condition where these channels have been found to be constitutively active. And so we don't understand the mechanism by which this happens, but if we could have a small molecule that binds where beta-gamma binds and prevents it from activating, potentially this could be a blocker, and it could be a fairly specific blocker that only targets this GERK channel and not other effectors, let's say, or other molecules that look similar in some respects to this channel. So we can have a tool to basically block the channel in a very specific way. There is another utility of knowing how beta-gamma interacts with the GERK channel that is actually more of a very critical knowledge of this field. And that is that G-protein signaling happens in just about every cell in response to environmental stimuli like hormones, neurotransmitters. And although this is ubiquitous and maybe as much as 50% of the drugs that we have target these G-protein-coupled receptors, we really don't understand in molecular terms how this complex of receptor G-proteins and effectors and, you know, whatever the effector may be, in our case it's a channel, how that signaling transmits itself in molecular detail. So if we had a structure that connected all the components, that we had the receptor, the G-proteins, and the effector all in one macromolecular complex, then we could test whether conformation changes of one, let's say like happens when acetylcholine binds the muscarinic receptor, can be transmitted from part to part, from the receptor to the G-proteins to the channel, without actually having these components come apart and travel far. If you look at textbooks, in fact, you see that the G-proteins dissociate and they travel to find their effectors, and it's not at all clear that this model is possible, as opposed to one where all the components are one machine, you know, that couples very carefully and without having to go very far with its component to transmit a signal. So, you know, this is a start of a process, actually, you know, where we need to figure out how all the components fit together and how the puzzle can be solved.
Raul, could your computational strategy be adapted to study protein-protein interactions in other contexts where crystallizing a complex has been difficult?
Absolutely. In the paper, we provide full details of the way we carried out the docking and combined the different published docking programs. And with a little bit of computational know-how and access to some computational resources, anyone could really adapt it to their proteins of interest. I do want to mention that when we carried out our docking, we were able to constrain the docking somewhat because of known interactions of the channel with the lipid bilayer of the cell membrane, and also of the G-beta gamma being tethered to the membrane. And knowing this helped to constrain somewhat the search space of our docking. So, you know, if somebody can find some bit of experimental information to constrain their docking, then I think that'll certainly help with their proteins of interest. And, of course, that would have to be followed up with some sort of experimental evidence as well.
Thank you, Raul and Diomedes, for talking with me about your paper.
So, thank you, Annalisa, and have a good day.
Thanks for having us. It's been a pleasure.
That was Diomedes Logothetis and Raul Mahajan, authors of a paper published in the August 13th issue of Science Signaling. That paper is by Mahajan and colleagues, and it's titled, A Computational Model Predicts That G-Beta Gamma Acts at a Cleft Between Channel Subunits to Activate GERK1 Channels. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and AAAS, Advancing Science, Serving Society. If you have any questions or comments, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for listening.